Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is August 6th, 2004. Today's session number is MOJ 2004-04. Today's speaker is John Moeller. And the lesson for today is Politics as the Way We the People Summon Out What We Shall Be. Politics, Civil Disobedience, and Conscious Objection. Let's listen in.
A couple minutes late, and suspect at this point everyone is
it's getting ready for you. It's kind of like that last day with the semester, and I always like to quote T.S. Eliot that my class is in, not with a bang, but with a whimper. And, you know, so I never had any. Actually, I'm going to come back tomorrow. But in semesters, I never have any exciting ends. You know, I just sort of talk, and then, okay, I'll see you. And things sort of get that way at that time. And again, for those of you who might not know, my name is John Moeller. I teach political science at Luther College. And this week, I've been looking at the idea of politics as a way that we collectively can make some choices about our society. We've looked thus far at trying to define politics and think about it as a way of doing activity. Looked a little bit at the relationship between principle and politics, the practical and those kinds of tensions. Yesterday we talked about the role of the courts, and the courts is a policymaker, and how sometimes that can come in tension with the political process. And today we're going to look at the idea of civil disobedience and conscientious objection, and the way that things like civil disobedience and conscientious objection can perhaps further politics, perhaps sometimes can be at odds with politics. And we can begin with the postcard that was given to me just a couple minutes ago, which has the person saying, "Should I abide by the rules until they're changed, or help speed the change by breaking them?" And in a way, that's I think does raise the question pretty well. I think what I want to do today is, first of all, just because for my own sake, it should be apparent to people who have come for a few times that I have to think of these things conceptually, and I love to draw diagrams on the blackboard because it helps me put things in order, and I've got this obsessive need for everything to sort of fit somewhere and try to organize it that way. And so what I want to do is give you just sort of an overview of a way of thinking about civil disobedience and conscientious objection, lay out some positions, and then would really like to spend the period thinking about some of these different choices, get some sense of what you think about civil disobedience, what you think about different kinds of activities that I would call civil disobedience, with the hope that we're not going to try to bring a resolution to this, but with the hope that at some point you might sort of be able to draw a line, what sorts of actions that are disobedient are okay, which ones aren't okay, and so forth. Let me begin by thinking of it this way, and I must confess that when I decided to do this as one of the topics for this week, I did it with the idea in mind that probably a lot of people here are coming to Holden Village because they feel strongly about their faith, and they have strong ideas about what it is to be a good person, and that oftentimes is in tension with what it is to be a good citizen. So I would start by, and someday I'm going to take art from one of the professors at college and put more of my little stick figures, and I'm pretty good sometimes. I can put frowns and smiles on them, but this is about the best I can do. And it seems to me that when we think about civil disobedience, one way to think about it is it oftentimes grows out of us finding ourselves in a dilemma in which we're torn between what it is to be a good person and what is required to be a good citizen. And so we can find, and I'm going to, you know, I'll do sort of the vertical thinking and assume that truth is transcendent and it's up here, and this could be truth, or this could be God, this could be the agathon, the good for Plato. It could be whatever. And I would say that to be a good person, you know, sometimes we feel we're morally obligated
to live a life that pursues the truth. And that's a moral obligation. We find ourselves in a tough situation, and I say, well, what should I do? And I say, well, I've got a moral obligation not to lie. Or I've got a moral obligation to help my neighbors. Or I've got a moral obligation to do whatever that truth requires. And that, it seems to me, is part of what it means to be a good person. I mean, obviously, if this were a philosophy class, we could spend a whole semester trying to figure out what exactly is required to be a good person. But again, the point is that sometimes we're pulled here. And sometimes that's at odds with, if we come down here to our living in the city, and especially in the city with, you know, where we're governed by laws, I would say that to be a good citizen actually also imposes a moral obligation on us. Now, again, you know, we could talk about different kinds of states, but I would say living in a democracy, accepting the ideas of essentially contract, that when I contract to live with the rest of you and to be a member of a citizen, it's not just that you know, I'm going to get arrested if I go too fast. It's not just that there's going to be chaos. It's not just the practical utilitarian. There's going to be chaos here if we don't all follow the law. I'd be prepared to argue that, in fact, as a citizen, I have a moral obligation to live according to the laws that we've agreed upon among ourselves collectively. And so the trick, the dilemma, is that sometimes I'm standing here, and so I'm, you know, literally divided in half, because I find myself in a situation where, on the one hand, I feel this is what I really ought to do to be a good person. But I also know that that runs contrary to the laws of the state. And I say to myself, yes, but I also have obligations as a citizen. And the best of all worlds is Plato's ideal state, where everybody is following the rules of the philosopher, and being a good person and being a good state are the same thing. And we've got the philosopher king. I mean, that's the whole idea, that philosophers will be kings, where we can co-join philosophy and rulership. But as far as I know, this doesn't happen anywhere. And so we find ourselves in that tension. Now, how do we deal with that tension? And sort of thinking about this in the level of the issues involved in civil disobedience. And I was going to, you know, if I could really draw a well, I was going to superimpose on this, but I won't do that. And instead, I'll just make over here a different continuum. And I want to suggest sort of three broad areas in this continuum. On the one hand, I say that whenever this dilemma exists, my primary obligation is an adherence to the law. And let me give you two examples of this that I find interesting, and because also I'll be able to maybe read something. One is, this is Socrates' argument. Now, many of you have probably read the Apology. It's sort of a typical thing that you oftentimes read in college. I think they used to read it in our first year Paideia course at Luther for many years. And it's basically this, you know, Socrates has gone down to the marketplace and he's tried to engage the young men and encourage them to think contrary to maybe what they're being told by their elders and so forth. As a result of all this, he's put on trial. So the Apology, the trial of Socrates. And he's found guilty. And so we read this, and it's really interesting because people usually just read the Apology. They say, this is a great call for challenging the state. And it is a call for challenging the state. Philosophy challenging the state out there and not being afraid to challenge the leaders and so forth. But then he goes to prison, and the thing that people don't read too often is the Crito, which is a much shorter little dialogue by Plato. And Crito, the jail, or Crito essentially comes in and he's prepared. In fact, he's bribed the jailer that the jailer's going to let Socrates escape. And so he tells Socrates, this is great, Socrates, I've done you a great favor. We're going to get you out of here because I was able to bribe this guy and he can leave Athens and you can escape, you can bring your family with you, everything's going to be good. Socrates says, I can't. I can't do it. That would be wrong. It would be wrong for me not to suffer the punishment It would be wrong for me to challenge the laws. And so he's been willing to challenge particular ideas, but now this would be a rejection of the law. And he says, I can't do that. I mean, it was the laws that begat me, the laws that nurtured me, the laws that educated me. It was the laws that made philosophy possible. I couldn't have had these conversations down at the Agora if there wasn't this law. And so for me to reject that would be something I simply can't imagine doing. And so what we find, in fact, in the end with Socrates, it's a classic example of essentially the adherence to law, in which ultimately he rejects civil disobedience. He rejects rejecting the law and says his ultimate final obligation has to be to the law. Now, let me just give you one other example of this, just because if you're looking for something good to read sometime, it's a little Western. Maybe some of you have read it, The Oxbow Incident. Maybe you've even seen there's a nice little movie of Henry Fonda in it, sort of a typical old Western. And it's written by a guy by the name of Clark, Walter Van Tilburg Clark. And it's a great little novel, because you've got this character by the name of Davies, and there's a posse out there, and he's using the West to set the stage, and the posse is going to go out and collect these rustlers, these people who have been rustling the cattle, because the law is not working very well. And Davies says, you can't do this, and he argues against doing that. And at the key moment, and it's a great teaching novel, it really is, because it requires students to think hard about an important question. At a key moment, he could probably stop the hanging that's going to take place, because the mob out there is just on the verge of, they just need someone to push them over. But he refuses to do something like pull out a gun and step outside of the law and use force to change their minds. He relies exclusively on reasoned argument, because he believes this is the only way he can operate is within the law, and they go out and hang the people, and he could have stopped them. But he doesn't, because again, he says, I have to adhere to the law. Even in the name of justice, I can't step outside of the law and act in what might be an unjust way, but for a very good reason, and then step back into the law. He says, the law is the law, and I have an obligation to adhere to it. If it's going to mean anything, I can't pick and choose when I'm going to follow it. I have to adhere to it all the time. And so one position then at the extreme is to argue that the way you resolve this tension between being pulled toward truth and being pulled toward the city is to simply adhere to the laws of the city as long as we're living in the city. And I think, a very devout Christian could easily agree to do this, especially if you're Augustinian and you think that there's a city of God and a city of human beings and we're just sojourners here. And the main thing we've got to do is maintain order and peacefulness and livability. And when it's all done, there'll be some other justice anyway. But here and now, it's an easy choice. You adhere to the law. Now, it seems to me then we can say, though, that there is over here a very broad area, and this is the area of civil disobedience, and there's lots of ways we could define this. Let me just read you really quickly the definition that that Alexander Bickel gives. He says, civil disobedience is the act of disobeying formally binding general law on grounds of moral or political principle without challenging the validity of the law. So in other words, I challenge this individual law, but I don't reject the idea of law, the validity of the law, and in fact, I'm willing to be punished by that law because I'm not asking for an exception, but I'm still going out there and actually I'm disobeying the formally binding laws, but knowing I'll probably get punished for that and I'll take my punishment because that's part of the agreement. Or the incidental disobedience of general law, which is itself neither challenged as invalid nor disapproved of in the course of agitating for change in public policies, actions, or social conditions, which are regarded as bad on grounds of moral or political principle, all in circumstances where the legal order makes no allowance for the disobedience. Because sometimes the legal order gives us room to disobey. But these are essentially where you disobey the law. You disobey the law in the name of some higher principle, but you don't reject the law, the validity of the law. And so let me just give you a couple examples of this. One is obviously the Martin Luther King Jr., in which, you know, he rejects the law. He's supposed to get this parade permit. He doesn't do it. He gets thrown into jail, and he writes this very famous letter from the Birmingham jail in which he argues that the law is unjust, and he gives a fairly distinct explanation of why the law is unjust, what an unjust law entails, but then fully expects to be punished for it because he doesn't reject the validity of law. But he says this particular law is unjust. Another example of this, I think, and I only throw this out because maybe we'll talk about it if you want, and it's one of my favorite things to think about because I don't know where I stand on it. This has become a theme as well, I suspect, that I don't know where I stand on these things. And I think it comes awful close to civil disobedience enough that I would throw it out because it's in the air off and on these days, and that's jury nullification. Jury nullification is where the jurors make a decision that what runs contrary to what the law requires them to decide, but they do it by appealing to some higher moral argument or some higher morality. So the first couple of times that Dr. Kevorkian in Michigan was charged with assisted suicide, which was clearly against the law. I mean, the evidence was there, and the law was clear, but the jurors said, we're not going to convict this guy because we think it's a bad law. Or the more interesting example oftentimes that I ask students to think about, you know, what about the elderly couple in which one is suffering from some disease that is just sort of destroying them, and the other assists the spouse in committing suicide, or actually takes the spouse's life as an act of grace, perhaps, a favor that they're doing for the spouse. And then you have, and oftentimes these things happen, and we don't have aggressive prosecutors, and they just sort of, you know, everyone says, that's okay, we'll live with this, it's messy. But every once in a while, you've got an aggressive prosecutor says, not in my territory are there going to be murders like this. And so they'll bring a case and it comes in front of the jury, and the jury will be compassionate, and the jury will say, yep, broke the law. Nope, we're not going to convict. Now, actually, this happened a lot during Prohibition, and it probably contributed to the end of Prohibition, because people would come in, they'd be charged with violating this liquor laws, and everyone on the jury would say, whoa, that could be me. You know, this is a really crummy law. And so they acquitted these people. And actually, that contributed to the changing of the policy. But it's an interesting situation, I think, where in a very formal capacity, the jurors are actually acting as disobedience. They're not doing what the judge has told them to do. They're not doing what the law requires them to do. But they can do it. And of course, there's not going to be any punishment to them. And by the way, there's a huge debate in American legal circles today as to whether or not nullification is an okay thing to do, and if it's okay, whether or not the judge ought to tell the jury that they can engage in nullification. It's a very interesting debate. Yeah?
What about the judges that flip against what the jury said? For example, in death penalty cases where the jury, in Alabama, the jury won't give the death penalty once in a while, and the judge will supersede them and say, yes, they can. Would that be same idea, different idea?
Well, I'm trying
The other example, excuse me, where the judge recently was kicked off because he ruled against the creed being.
That was the Alabama judge, right? Who ruled? Oh, wait.
He got kicked off the
Ten Commandments
case.
Oh, praise God, yes. Don't get me started on Roy Moore.
Yeah,
and
let's not go there.
There he got censored by the...
Well, you can hear all about it.
Well, I mean, that's kind of in reverse.
Yeah.
It didn't work.
No, but he was really flaunting a federal law, and we could go. That's like 2 hours with me.
But the other one, you know, there was this case that was just handed down by the Supreme Court this year that a lot of people think is going to be fairly contentious because it did say that it was a state case. It was out here, wasn't it? Was it in the West, I think, where that the judge could not issue the death penalty where the jury had not heard the evidence on that. So it was actually sort of a right to jury trial case in which the judge couldn't make that action without the jury having deliberated on it. I don't know if that exactly addresses that, but yeah.
Jury nullification is done all the time in Jim Crow South.
Yes.
And probably, we might argue the moral reasons there, but I mean.
Right, and this is of course, you know, a great example. And let me just say right now, this is, when you look at jury nullification and you look at, when someone makes an act of civil disobedience, they're appealing up to the truth, right? They're appealing to some idea of justice. And the problem, of course, with all of these things, it can cut both ways, right? So sometimes jury nullification can be a compassionate thing that we would agree with, and sometimes it could be used to convict someone. I mean, it was used in the South all the time against even though the evidence would be there, and it would be used against actually the black person being tried. And so it really does. It does sort of cut both ways. Let me just give you the one last point over here that we can just talk about this, and that is conscientious objection. Conscientious objection seems to me to be a little different than civil disobedience in that it doesn't publicly engage the legal system with an intent to change, but rather it relies on the individual almost withdrawing from the system and pitting his or her moral point of view, his or her conscience, against the state. There's a kind of certitude, a kind of arrogance, it seems to me, in conscientious objection, because conscientious objection, rather than necessarily engaging the state, as Martin Luther King Jr. tried to do, asserts my conscience, my moral position, and says, I will do what I have to do because I will not be bound by the state under any conditions whatsoever. So the conscientious objector, for example, might be the person who, during the 1960s or early 70s, refuses to go to the draft, and might either do this by going to Canada or might do this by simply avoiding the induction and hiding somewhere in the United States. No attempt to engage the public in a change and try to persuade the public that the laws that are currently being used are unjust, but simply asserts, in this case, his authority versus the state's and withdraws. Or another example, and let me give you this one and let me ask you what you think about this. Because I don't actually know if this is conscientious objection or civil disobedience. Maybe it's right on the line. And it's an issue that's interested me for a long time. It's no longer alive, but I still think it's really interesting. If you might remember, in the early 1980s, there was a movement that was actually labeled by the press as the Sanctuary Movement, in which, down in the Southwest, a number of individuals, it was a fairly small group of people, actually, a rancher, some, mostly I think it grew out of the Presbyterian Church, but I'm not positive, essentially opposed American policy involving immigration, and essentially were sneaking Central Americans, Salvadorans and others, across the border and then running them through the United States, oftentimes coming up to places like Seattle where they would find some sort of sanctuary. And of course they referred to it as the Sanctuary Movement because it went back to that idea that individuals can be provided sanctuary in the church and the state ought not be able to reach that. And I've always been torn about this situation. And I always imagined, okay, let's say we're at church. You know, it's Sunday morning, we're down in Tucson. This grew out of Tucson. And after church, we're having coffee, and you know, someone says, you know, these Salvadorans are dying because they're coming to the border and they're getting sent back. Or these, you know, Guatemalans, and they're getting sent back. And I think American policy is wrong. And I think we have to do something. And my moral beliefs tell me that the appropriate thing is to do, now I know in the long term I ought to try to change government policy, but that's not going to do anything for that Salvadoran who I saw on the border last night being arrested by an agent and sent back. I'm not interested in long term at this point. I'm interested in harboring those people and getting them across the border. If you were in that, you know, that coffee discussion after church, and maybe you just had a sermon talking about helping your neighbor and referring to, you know, the Good Samaritan and the obligations of what it is to be a good person, what kind of arguments might you weigh in? And again, you know, I like to think of that setting because you don't have to have a final judgment on this. We're just trying to figure out over coffee, should we do this or not? So you start throwing arguments out against, you know, with each other. What kind of arguments might you throw out there in trying to figure out, should I be a good citizen? Should I be a good person? Do I have a right to engage in this kind of activity?
Well, being a good citizen, it seems to me, doesn't mean that you promote the idea that the state is organic, that it's a living form in itself, and that it cannot be touched in any way. And there's a danger in that all the time, that you get the majority of people who claim to be citizens, and they really are belying a trend that it's kind of dangerous.
So you mean too unwilling to challenge?
The concept of the state, we have to be careful on that when we talk mm-hmm. about things like this. You know, it's a delicate thing, you know, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And so I'd probably argue we have to harbor them. You know, it's even maybe a question of not so much, there might not even be a law on it, I don't know, but it even goes beyond civil disobedience, I think, in that sense.
Yeah, in fact, the reason I'm not sure where to put it, because it seems to me that they secretively bring these people across seems to me to put it more in the area of conscientious objection. Yeah?
We had a friend involved in this, and they were pretty organized, and this was a matter of churches putting up a cash bond for someone who was held by the government, whose case then was to be heard, was to be dealt with, but taking that person out of custody for a cash amount and putting that person in, moving him somewhere and putting him in sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
And then normally the situation, I mean, we had a friend that did this with a couple of fellows, and that was a matter of, what if the case failed, then since we were in Minnesota, we were about to the Canadian border in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, they were working with the system and working with, you know, kind of giving the government a chance to do the right thing. But I think they were of the conviction that had this person been sent back, and this was Nicaragua in this case, had the person been sent back to Nicaragua, that they'd be executed.
Mm-hmm.
And they could not do that, could not allow that.
So in that final step, then they would help them get to Canada.
They would help them get to Canada. The church would be forfeiting that bond that they put mm-hmm. up. But they all understood what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's kind of a quasi thing because there is a little bit of mm-hmm. working with the government on that and giving the government its chance to do the right thing, so to speak.
But in the end, still making a judgment that at this point, we're not going to continue to comply with the
right.
various requirements here because we know this person might be sent back,
right.
and so we're simply going to do what our conscience requires us to do to send them on.
It's more complicated because in that case, the U.S. government may well be involved in the problem in Nicaragua mm-hmm.
illegally
against,
And how does that
influence? I don't see the problem with conscientious objection because I think you said conscientious objection is an individual acting mm-hmm. more or less within his own framework, you know, removing himself from the system. So I don't see the conscious objection connection. I see it more as civil disobedience, mm-hmm. but a different degree maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Asylum cases are a little bit in the same ballpark where you actually take on the system. You litigate against the INS and you try to protect people by claiming that they should be given asylum here, because if they are sent back, they'll face whatever horrors. And there, I'm not sure where that falls. It's a little more probably in the civil disobedience area, because you're, in effect, attacking the system. You're not just ignoring it and trying to stay away from it.
But aren't you using the system there?
Huh?
Aren't you using the system? Aren't you working within the system?
Well, but yeah, perhaps, although you in effect are saying that this person is illegally here, but they should be allowed to remain here. And you make your arguments in a litigated setting against the government.
But what about that final step where the church says, okay, we're not going to win on this one, and so at this point now we're going to help that person get up to Canada. Does that trouble anyone, the individuals making that judgment?
My sister lives in Arizona, and she worked in Tubac, which is just across the border. And sometimes when she would come to work early, there would be somebody who would come across kind of in the back of the building, hiding out and sleeping. Now, if she was the one that got there early, she said, I handed him my lunch and $5 and told him where to get the bus to Tucson.
Mm-hmm.
If there was another lady who got there first, she was on the phone to the INS. Mm-hmm. But my sister would say, here's my lunch, here's $5, it's where you get the bus.
Okay. And your sister did the right thing.
I think she did. I mean, that's what I think.
Yeah?
And I, again, decide where this belongs, but you know, up the valley at Stehekin, we were hearing that we stayed at the ranch in the Courtneys, you know, there was a log jam. And the Forest Service, we're not going to do anything about it, and they almost lost one of their kids because of that lost jam, or that log jam. So they just got together and dynamited it, and it was gone.
Uh-huh.
But if they said if we had waited for the Forest Service to do anything, it would still be there. So, you know, again, because of local jurisdiction, what they felt they had a right and a need to do, and bureaucracy was in the way, they just went ahead and made that choice.
And is that okay, you think?
I think it's okay.
Uh-huh. Because the end results were good?
Yeah. Well, in this case, this is not an individual making a determination for a community. It was a community making a determination for a community. And it,
you mean in the sanctuary?
In the Stehekin.
Oh, uh-huh.
And so you basically have levels of government clashing with each other. But they weren't.
Determination being made by every single person saying this person deserves sanctuary,
yeah.
Going against the government too, and you get to a point where the law, de facto, not really de jure, but the law is, if anybody thinks that somebody deserves sanctuary, that person should come to the country, and then you get into kind of an odd situation where you have a large scale illegal immigration, and that can sometimes lead to some problems too, possibly. I mean, if you want to make it fair for everybody, you should just have the law be that if anybody in the world wants to come here for any reason, we'll take them all in. You know, we can have a billion immigrants within a year, probably. But you know, it is something you need to think through. To the end, what are the consequences of this type of thing? And you know, just to give the other side of the coin here, which I'm not hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, except there is a consideration there if you feel that your country is responsible for those particular political refugees. Your country is supporting people in Nicaragua who are, you know, who shouldn't be supported.
Yeah, I understand both sides of the argument. I'm just saying it's a messy situation either way. One way your country is responsible for doing something illegally and you're sending somebody back to be executed. The other way you're opening up the floodgates for probably some people who maybe aren't in danger of being executed, but they're here for economic reasons or to possibly do things they shouldn't be doing here too.
Yeah.
John, aren't you trying to say that the community and the law are not so separated that they I don't want to say this. Someone made the comment about the community in Stehekin deciding that this was something that needed to be done, and so the community decided to break the law or in effect. But the community that made the law is not the community that just decided to break it. And the community that's doing this action is not the entire community that's affected. So what you said at the beginning is that the law is an agreed upon code by the entire society. And then, but what we're saying over here is that this is a small part of the society that's decided to change it. Not the entire society who made the law in the first place saying we need to reevaluate this.
Mm-hmm.
To think about it practically, you bust up the logjam, but maybe you do it improperly and it goes somewhere else and destroys something in the next community. I mean, that's an example of one part of the community changing the law as it best suits them without maybe taking into consideration the entire group of people affected by it in the first place, under the law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think the issue is that legal and illegal is not the same as right and wrong. However, in this country, it's supposed to represent what we as a whole community believe to be right and wrong. And so perhaps an act of conscientious objection and civil disobedience, I think that conscientious objection is inherent in civil disobedience, would be to work to change that law, be it through legal means of talking to your congresspeople or whatnot, or seeing to it that people seeking refuge have that opportunity. I think everyone has to fight for what they believe to be right.
Well, what if the guy that you handed $5 and a sandwich turns out to be a terrorist?
Well, it could be, yeah. She doesn't make that judgment, Jeff.
And we saw the logs coming out of our boat when we came up here.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so isn't the question, all right, so we've got justice up here, right? And let's say we all agree. We want a just society. And I think part of the question, it seems to me there's a couple issues here. One is, if the law is unjust, there's a point where we're not going to give our consent to it. But is law almost as much a process, a way of doing things, a way of holding us together, as a particular substance? And in fact, Bickel calls his book The Morality of Consent, because he says there is a morality in consenting to the law, because it's law that holds us together. Law is the social cement. And I mean, I'll try not to get too carried away here, but this is actually one of the things I must confess. I tell students, you know, I mean, I know law is flawed in the United States, but I have come to develop a kind of reverence for law. Because think about it, that I can go to New York City, millions of people, ride the subway, and not get accosted most of the time, I mean a large percentage of the time, is an amazing thing. I mean, I'm not a Hobbesian, but you can certainly understand Hobbes. I mean, you know, Hobbes has this vision of this chaotic world that's nasty, life's nasty and short and brutish, and people are going after each other all the time. And it is an absolutely amazing thing, and it's I think it's sort of a human creation in part, that we can have this law and we all buy into it and we all accept it. So that's the first point for me in thinking about this, that law plays that remarkable role. It's the fundamental social institution that makes everything else possible. I honestly do believe it's the value of values in society, because it's the underlying value that allows us to come together to do philosophy, to talk to each other, to seek justice in a collective setting. The problem, of course, is What do we do if that law, in fact, is not exactly lined with justice? I mean, that is the dilemma. And so I guess we maybe have different thresholds, but one question is, if it's an almost, well, I shouldn't say insignificant, but if it's not a huge injustice, is the importance of this process, this consent that are willing to live together, can that actually trump some injustices? And secondly, it seems to me, and here's where conscientious objection, I'll concede, it concerns me. And Greg's point is, I think, you know, articulates it better than I would have, that really the issue in part, I think, is, you know, whose justice is this and what picture are we looking at? And so, actually, in the Oxbow incident, Mr. Davies talks about the little we and the large we. And the immediate we are the people that are going to break up those logs. And yet, when they break up those logs, shouldn't they have to be responding to or appealing to a much larger we who collectively have created a society with certain rules? And how do we decide at what point, you know, well, let me give you another example, and I'll ask you where you stand on this one. I use this all the time in class. It involved a case, you know, in a neighborhood outside of Detroit. There was a crack house in that neighborhood. It was a working class neighborhood, lots of kids in the neighborhood. They kept going to the police. They kept asking the police to do something about this crack house. They would board it up and then it would get broken. And so finally one day, some of the neighbors got together and said, there's no justice in this law, so we're going to take care of this ourselves. And they made sure the wind conditions were right, they made sure nobody was in the house, and they burned the house down. They got prosecuted. And the lawyer argued jury nullification, essentially. I mean, he essentially argued, he didn't deny them doing it, but he persuaded them, or he tried to persuade the jury, that they ought not convict him because what they did was right. If you were on that jury, would you have convicted those people, or would you have acquitted those people?
I wouldn't have made it to the jury.
You wouldn't have, because you would have said something prior to that?
They
would have
eliminated me, right?
No, they might not have. You never know.
Kids, you know.
I think what they're fighting is not the law, but the enforcement of the law.
Okay.
So that would come into it, really.
So then would you say that the law is not being enforced adequately, and therefore you would acquit them?
Illegal to have crack.
Right.
So, where were the enforcers? Arresting the people in the houses?
But if the jury
but
not enforcing the law,
house down too, though.
Yeah, if your kids got hurt from the fire.
So then if the jury's not enforcing the law, do you burn the courthouse down too?
Like I said, I wouldn't meet it to a jury.
Yeah.
What do you do if you're, just put, what if you're, we're talking about vocation, what if you are called to the ministry, and you're giving an impassioned sermon on this topic, on any of these topics you've raised, and you're really going to have to say something like, I know what Christ suggests in the Gospels, I know to love your neighbor as yourself, and so forth, but I understand the law has to reign supreme. Now, has he followed his vocation? Has he followed his calling?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean,
students get to ask teachers questions once in a while.
Well, no, I think if any of you did go to the session that Mary Anderson did with the West Wing, I mean, this is exactly that same thing. The president's got to has certain obligations. It was involving whether or not he ought to commute a death sentence, and he's torn between his vocation as a government official and his beliefs as a private individual, a practicing Catholic who thinks that capital punishment is wrong. This is the Mario Cuomo situation as well. I mean, should Mario Cuomo, when he, and see, it cuts both ways. And so should Mario Cuomo because he believes abortion is wrong, and he has a profound religious belief that it's wrong, should he carry that over into his discussions as a governor of New York? Or should he say that, you know, that there's a difference between what we expect the law to do and what maybe we would expect God to have us do if this was a, if this really was a godly earth? I mean, I know where I stand, I think, on this, but I don't know. I mean, that's where I'm at. What do you do in a jury situation like that? I mean, do you acquit these people and say, you know, the law wasn't being enforced, people weren't doing the right things? Geez, I would have done the same thing. Or do you say, well, geez, you know, the law, I mean, it's the law. You can't go around burning houses. I don't know. Yeah, Dave. Yeah.
Well, I don't mean to digress, but you mentioned capital punishment, which has been bothering me for some time, because the pendulum swings back and forth. Some states allow it, some states prohibit it. This is even a worldwide problem with countries taking positions. But to bring it much closer, I have problems with the district attorney, who has a reputation of how many people he can fry, and being allowed to ask me, before I get to be on the jury, would I vote for death penalty? And if I feel very strongly about it, for the sake of discussion, what if I would say I'm for it, so I can get on the jury and vote against it?
That's a great. Would you do that? Would you be willing to do that?
Well, fortunately, I live in a state that prohibits it.
But no, I mean, that's a great, would you say that this is I know I'm going to engage in an act of deceit, but this is an act of deceit that is going to grow out of a higher sense of justice, and so I'm willing to do it.
Well, I thought about that, because at that point, I don't think you have sworn to uphold the law yet.
I mean, let me just say first, that would be an act of conscientious objection, wouldn't it? Because it would be private, it would be secretive, and you wouldn't be engaging anyone, but you would simply be pitting your moral belief against societies without necessarily trying to get society to change it.
My moral beliefs against the district attorneys.
Okay.
It's not the district attorney's it's the law. He has taken an oath to uphold the law.
But right. Some of them aggressively go after the death penalty and others don't.
That's fine. But if the law permits it, they can be as aggressive as they want. And so some could argue that if they aren't being aggressive, they are holding their oath. So, I mean, I think whenever you get into the business of lying to get on a jury or deciding based on something other than the law, as instructed by the judge, I think you get on a very slippery slope. Then juries all over the country could start doing that on multitudes of issues. Mm-hmm. I think you have to have a fundamental respect for, first, the law, and then the jury system that enforces the law. And if you get away from that, even for high-minded reasons, the concept of the law that you pointed out as being fundamental starts toppling. I think it's a very slippery slope.
So in other words, you're saying that the individual in that case, the idea of the law is so important, the individual can't morally object by deceiving the court.
Right. You can morally object by saying, no, I could not in good conscience vote for the death penalty if given a place on this jury. And then if you're disqualified from the jury because of that, fine. You've satisfied your own moral conscience. You are not in a position, but you haven't lied to get there to then disobey the law.
That's a really interesting point. I mean, because oftentimes acts of conscientious objection do involve, I think I would argue, an attempt to coerce the law to see your moral position, when oftentimes a legitimate, acceptable alternative is to resign from your position, to step down and say, I cannot act immorally. And I mean, that in itself is another whole huge question. What does it require? Is it enough that you now abdicate, that you step down and you say that I'm not going to become morally or immorally complicit in this? Or do you have an obligation or a right to try to coerce the system to see your moral point of view. I think that's really interesting. Ren, did you still have a...
Well, this is a not capital punishment, nothing that big, but it comes after something you said about doing your godly duty versus doing what the law says. And we had a situation about 3 years ago on a holiday weekend. We went to the Mississippi with our kids, and we got out to the sandbar, which for those of you that are in that area, you realize on a holiday weekend, a bunch of people show up out there. And it's a public sandbar on public ground, and we take our kids out there with, and there's other kids out there, but by Sunday afternoon on Labor Day weekend, the activities that are going on that sandbar are not what you want your six-year-old and your eight-year-old to be witnessing. And I mean, we as adults can deal with it and, you know, don't make a big stink about it, but I left there thinking, who's going to legislate the activity on this public sandbar, and do the people of lowest morality win there because they will do whatever they feel like? And I guess I'm getting back to the point, I had somebody say to me then at another gathering, well, you can't legislate morality. And I used that exact example with her, and I said, you know what, maybe, you know, she was saying, we can't have people coming down on us through the legislative system and telling us how our morals should be. And I said, that may be true if you've got everybody who's making the laws of like morals. But I said, to the extent that you have people of unlike morals in the system, then you need laws to help govern your society. And I think that's what you're getting to in that law is the process by which we decide how we're going to live together. Mm-hmm. And I just, when you say, do you do your godly thing or you do what the law says, you'd like to think those two things somehow are connected. But to the extent that they aren't, then there's going to be conflict.
And to the extent that they aren't, then you weigh toward saying you have to follow the law?
Well, and then I'll give you one other kind of non-big theory example, but I think about our drive out here. And I don't know how many of you drove faster than the speed limit whenever you could, but I think we as a society push the limits. We will push the limit, and we found out what the limit was.
Which state?
Best idea.
The little we found out.
Which state?
Montana.
So much for this, you can drive as fast as you want. Yeah. Maybe yours was the car we saw pulled over. Yeah.
But anyway, my point being that, and even whether it was Montana or in Iowa, I know how fast you can drive where you won't get a ticket, but you are driving over the legal limit. And any of these other discussions, whether it's the sanctuary issue or something even bigger than that, we as a society will tolerate a certain amount of disobedience to the law, but if so many people come in that we have immigration problems and it becomes overwhelming, then we as a society say, oh, wait a minute, we have to contain this problem because we have laws against this. And I just think somewhere between black and white, there's this gray area of tolerance oftentimes that, for better or for worse, it's how you deal with the complexities of some of the issues.
Yeah, and I want to just emphasize that quickly, because I think you're right. There's huge, it's a rubber band. There's huge flexibility here. And there are lots of, you know, there's lots of cases of assisted suicide that never get prosecuted because there's kind of we can live with this area. I mean, it's not a black and white kind of thing. On the other hand, I think, pardon?
The death penalty is, you're either dead or you're not. I mean, that's, never mind the speeding.
Yeah.
That's a small degree, but death penalty is where you're divided. Half the nation thinks it's a great thing, and the other half thinks it's not.
But as long as we're divided, we still have the question of whether or not the single individual can, in a sense, coerce the system by engaging in deceit to get on the jury to block what currently is the legally accepted situation.
I was going to say, I'd throw another element in there of, then you can transpose onto that, was the person remorseful? I mean, back to the godly, was that person remorseful for the crime that they played, or did they not care at all? And I think about Timothy McVeigh, when they killed him, I looked at that and I thought, that guy just does not care that he killed all those people. And that, to tell you the truth, that had an impact on my feeling about his death.
Yeah.
You know, so the, to me, that starts creating that gray area.
Start personalizing, yeah. Individualizing
yep.
it.
Yep.
Yeah.
In my synod, we elected a new bishop not long ago, and at the assembly, six people stood for bishop, and they were all asked individually if upholding your responsibility as bishop of this synod at some point goes counter to your understanding of the gospel or of Christ, then what do you do? And there were six different answers, and they ranged from I would do what the I would uphold the church law, to I would resign. Mm-hmm. And then in the middle was I would uphold it kind of until I couldn't do it anymore, and then I would break it, or I would just break it from the start, you know, sort of thing
yeah.
like that. And so in thinking about the you mentioned the West Wing episode that Mary showed, where the president kind of squelches his own morals in favor of upholding his vocation as president. Then I think of the ordination of Anita Hill in Minneapolis, who's a lesbian, and the pastors and bishops who participated in that, knowing that it was against the teachings of the church, which I think goes back to the red card that you read at the beginning. Do you change the law by breaking, or do you what did it say?
Should I abide by the rules until they're changed,
right.
or help speed the change by breaking them?
Right. So does the president abide by the rule until it's changed, or do these bishops speed the change by mm-hmm. breaking them? And what's interesting is one of the bishops I know who participated resigned right after that and said that it's gotten to the point where I can no longer do this in my
right.
conscience.
Which is a, now I know we've got to go, there's one hand over here, right? Or, yeah.
I was just going to say, quite a long time ago in this discussion, you talked about how the law might take precedence over justice, especially if it's a small thing, because it's the glue that holds us together. But then if you think about what would have happened with the civil rights movement, there was a glue holding together a system that was unjust
mm-hmm.
for a whole group of people, and there were many, many little things that were disobeyed, like where you're supposed to sit on the bus, and which school you're supposed to go to, and that people refused to do. And they were small things, but they were all part of a much bigger thing that was breaking. It was separating out this glue that shouldn't be stuck together, you know. It did create some chaos, but it's only through chaos that change can take place. So sometimes we have to allow things to get disorderly for a while to make a big change.
I think you're absolutely right, and if you allow me just to make a real quick concluding, I mean, I think that's why we all admire Martin Luther King Jr., because he did that, but he did that all of within the context and reverence for the idea of law. He didn't bring a lawyer to argue against the case necessarily, you know, I shouldn't be charged for this. He wanted to be charged. And remember, the police were willing to work something out. No, I want to be punished for this because I want to demonstrate publicly that the law is unjust. It's not a private act. It's not my moral belief. I'm appealing to a higher natural law, and here are the reasons it's unjust, and he explains those very clearly with his 3 points he makes in his letter from Birmingham jail. And he's drawing people into the conversation, and ultimately has tremendous confidence that time will vindicate him. And it's a risk. It's a real risk for someone to go out and do that. And I think it requires self-confidence, and one has to be careful about when you do that. But again, there was never the arrogance that sometimes can exist with self-righteous moral certitude. He was appealing using reason and arguments and putting it all out there with the hope that collectively we would change our opinion and modify the laws.
But still, so he got rid of, he changed the tone of the cement, and he changed the way it was cemented, but he never broke that cement, because he always was doing this, grounding this in the idea of law, but the recognition that these particular laws are bad, but not the idea of law, not the role of the state, and so forth. I know we're over, but I will, yeah.
No, I mean, he had a very clear understanding of justice.
Absolutely.
And people appreciate that and understand it and ultimately see the rightness in that.
That's right, and he articulated it for everyone to, it wasn't my point on justice, and he was appealing to a long tradition of natural justice and so forth, yeah.
But we're looking at it in retrospect, and at the time people thought it was unjust, and so the problem here is, what is the definition, what do we think justice is, and everybody has a different idea of what justice is, and so therefore, we all have, so we see some civil disobedience is okay and others is not. And I just want to point out that while I definitely agree with what Martin Luther King Jr. did, there were people at the time who thought it was outrageous.
You're right. And that's the reason, it seems to me, part of this, the civil disobedient, is a person of a certain kind of moral character and genuine humility. But confidence that, because you're right, the only validation, it seems to me, of acts of civil disobedience will be in time, after the fact. And after the fact, we all do know that, well, he was right. Isn't that great that he was willing to risk his life for that, to make that point to us? But one has to understand that, I think, before one jumps out there and makes these claims. Yeah.
How many people got injured by Rosa Parks violating the law versus McVeigh? You know, I mean, I guess I would look at that, you know, whom do you injure in the way? You don't injure many people when you're a conscientious objector.
Oh, but actually, that's another really interesting question, isn't it? Because you can be a passive objector, but the consequences of your actions are beatings and snarling dogs. And actually, I think that in itself is an interesting question. Should the potential consequences of your being a pacifist and your nation goes in revolution as a result of this, and all kinds of people were killed in India, it seems to me. I mean, I'm not saying that that's a negative thing, but that's an interesting question, too, in terms of, are you responsible?
The States, there were civil rights workers.
Pardon me?
I say even in the States, there were civil rights workers.
That's right. And so, I mean, there was a lot of violence that grew out of a passive civil disobedience. And I'm not saying that...
Yeah, but mostly it was violence against the people who were disobeying, and
that's true.
And they were willing to pay the price, you know, so their disobedience wasn't as bad in my mind.
Some of those people who were killed, you know, those black families, but I've carried you over, it's time to go eat, so thanks, and hope to something to think about some of that.